Good evening, folks, and welcome back on this Saturday, the third day of October 2020. I'm your host, Mark Call, and we better start our look at what the heck is going on right here, because the left still seems to be just thrilled with reports that President Trump has tested positive, along with Melania, for the dreaded booga 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 virus. The most serious effects seem to be that there'll be a 14-day quarantine, and thus no major campaign events, and at least for 2 weeks, Joe Biden doesn't have to worry about memorizing lines for a debate. And the idiot far left is actually peddling the conspiracy theory that maybe he's faking it to incur sympathy. Yeah, from them? Are you kidding me? And maybe postpone the election. Isn't that their game all the way around? As for your host, since no one else is, I'll simply point out that the odds are it's a false positive anyway. Not like the left would have any interest in pulling that off, right, Michael Moore? But since we're pretty much there anyway, and a reasonable recap would have to start here besides, let's talk about Tuesday night's cage match, as some are calling it. The train wreck. And see, you know what I'm talking about. It was downright embarrassing. I realize he was probably counseled, hey, see if you can make Joe Biden angry. He'll lose his cool, come unglued, and America will see the real truth here. The trouble is, he made most of us mad. The guy is doddering. He's senile. Just let him talk and embarrass himself. You don't have to try to push him into it, Mr. President. On the other hand, the senile one seems to have been counseled, and in this case probably correctly, whatever you do, don't say, oh, come on, man. And he didn't. But he did get real close once. The trouble is, the expectations for Biden were at nursing home level. All the guy has to do to win, quote-unquote, is to not drool on his tie and confuse numbers like 1,000 with 100 million. When it was over, I found myself thinking about the old statement, never try to wrestle with a pig. You just get filthy, and the pig loves it. For once, and arguably only once, I did have to agree with the headline New York Times commentary, how the Internet viewed the first presidential debate poorly. Wrote Matt Stevens, in these polarized political times, it can sometimes feel as if Americans cannot really agree on anything. But Tuesday's highly anticipated presidential debate, the first, as you know, blah-de-blah-de-blah, managed to achieve a rare bipartisan consensus. Just about everyone offering commentary online agreed that the debate was an unmitigated disaster. The night's 90-minute commercial-free crosstalk extravaganza may not be something viewers will particularly want to review in detail upon waking up Wednesday morning, but as one political journalist suggested, Tuesday's event may very well go down as, quote, the worst debate of all time. And he summarizes it as so much yelling. And this is as close as the rest of the piece gets to laying it out truthfully. During the first 5 minutes, says Stevens for the NYT, the moderator asked a question, Mr. Trump answered, and Mr. Biden responded after that. And then Mr. Biden interrupted Mr. Trump during a discussion about the Supreme Court, and, well, that was the end of structure and civility. Mr. Trump would go on to interrupt Mr. Biden at nearly every opportunity. He doesn't say it, I will. And just about every time it was when Biden was lying through his teeth. But here's the leftist slanted retort. And quote, Mr. Biden would not let many of Mr. Trump's misstatements go unchallenged. Ah. That's not, however, to say that I don't blame the president for getting angry. Especially with that arrogant cretin, Chris Wallace, that was moderating the so-called debate. Who obviously not only knew where he was supposed to underhand the slow pitches, but proved that he was more of a prima donna than both of the guys on the stage combined. And whether or not the president was trying to goad sleepy quid pro Joe, the truth is that Chris Wallace certainly managed to goad him. And it started early, with this attack masquerading as a question by Chris Wallace.
On health care, and then we'll come back to Roe v. Wade.
All right.
Mr. President, the Supreme Court will hear a case a week after the election in which the Trump administration, along with 18 state attorneys general, are seeking to overturn Obamacare, to end Obamacare. You have spent the last...
Because they want to give good health care.
If I may ask my question, sir.
Good health care.
Over the last 4 years, you have promised to repeal and replace Obamacare, but you have never in these 4 years come up with a plan...
Now, I have one major advantage here, folks, given that I'm editing this later. I can stop that scumbag, shut him up, and say, hey, where the heck do you get off saying something like that, and why don't you let him respond? Because this isn't a question, it's an attack. And yeah, I will say this while I still have time, and that is, it really irritates the heck out of me that these statist socialists imply in the way they phrase their questions that the only alternative to socialist medicine is a plan for more federalized socialist medicine, just different. As if returning to a free market or even trying to move back in that direction somehow doesn't count. It's not an option, obviously. So I don't blame the president for being upset. Let's hear the whole thing.
Over the last 4 years, you have promised to repeal and replace Obamacare, but you have never in these 4 years come up with a plan, a comprehensive plan to replace Obamacare.
Of course I have.
Well, I'll give you an opportunity.
The individual mandate.
I'm going to give you an opportunity.
Excuse me. I got rid of the individual mandate, which was a big chunk of
Obamacare.
That is absolutely a big thing. That was the worst part of Obamacare. Chris, that was the worst part of Obamacare.
Let me ask my question.
Well, that may have been the truest thing Wallace said all night. The president is clearly debating him and not Biden.
Chris,
you're
that was the worst part of Obama.
Let me ask my question.
Well, I'll ask Joe. The individual mandate was the most unpopular aspect of Obamacare. I got rid of it.
I'd like you
and
to,
we will protect
Mr.
people
president,
with
President, I'm the moderator of this debate, and I would like you to let me ask my question, and then you can answer your question.
Go ahead.
You, in the course of these 4 years, have never come up with a comprehensive plan to replace Obamacare, and just this last Thursday, you signed a largely symbolic executive order to protect people with pre-existing conditions 5 days before this debate. So my question, sir, is what is the Trump health care plan?
Right. Well, first of all, I guess I'm debating you, not him, but that's okay. I'm not surprised. Let me just tell you something. That there's nothing symbolic. I'm cutting drug prices. I'm going with favored nations, which no president has the courage to do because you're going against big pharma. Drug prices will be coming down 80 or 90%. You could have done it during your 47-year period in government, but you didn't do it. Nobody's done it.
From there, it does, in fact, go fairly rapidly downhill. But this was at least illustrative. Listen carefully.
We're going to allow our governors now to go to other countries to buy drugs because when they pay just a tiny fraction.
As I say, this is open discussion.
No, but this is big. This is big stuff.
Sir, you'll be happy. I'm about to pick up on one of your points to ask the vice president, which is he points out.
Well, that's very nice of you, Chris. Let me bow at your feet and kiss your little toes. What a pompous twit. But here's the point. Trump was debating a guy who's pretty obviously senile, but was on performance-enhancing drugs that at least enabled him to get more or less through 90 minutes without forgetting what he was running for or asking a question to his earwig, while Wallace did the dirty work of attacking his opponent for him and shielding him from any responses. Case in point, you knew darn well that both the New York Times and Atlantic hit pieces were going to come up. Not even 15 minutes in, Wallace trots out the New York Times story about how you only paid $750 in federal income tax. I paid millions of dollars in taxes, millions of dollars of income tax, said the president in response. Show us your tax returns, interrupted Biden, who notably was not called out by the moderator. And the moderator, in turn, would not accept that answer. He kept pursuing the question anyway. In notable contrast to literally every time Biden evaded his questions, softballs though they were. And yet when the president tried to raise the real issues of corruption, the moderator was real quick to shut it down. This clip comes via the London Guardian, which has the headline, Trump interrupts Biden's tribute to late son to raise unfounded accusations. That pretty well lays out the tone of the censorship anyway.
The fact is that I've gone head-to-head with Putin and made it clear to him we're not going to take any of his stuff.
No, I think he's confusing Putin with Poroshenko. He went head-to-head with that guy and said if you want that billion-dollar loan, you'd better fire that prosecutor that's investigating me and my son Hunter. Remember? You won't hear this from Chris Wallace.
I said, you're not getting a billion. I'm going to be leaving here. I think it was, 6 hours? I looked, I said, I'm leaving in 6 hours. If the prosecutor's not fired, you're not getting the money. Oh, son of a got fired.
What did we hear last night?
He's Putin's puppy. He still refuses to even say anything to Putin about the bounty on the heads of American soldiers.
Your son got $3 billion.
And by the way, my son.
Wait a minute. Mr. President, your campaign agreed to both sides would get two-minute answers uninterrupted. Well, your side agreed to it, and Why don't you observe what your campaign agreed to as a ground rule, okay, sir?
He never keeps his word.
Can you add I'm not asking. That was a rhetorical question.
Can you add back 30 seconds?
You may have.
All right.
Go ahead.
So let's skip past the BS to get to the interesting stuff. Biden's going to point to the discredited Atlantic hit piece now. And guess which side the moderator's on?
And speaking of my son, the way you talk about the military, the way you talk about them being losers and being and just being suckers. My son was in Iraq. He spent a year there. He got the Bronze Star. He got the Conspicuous Service Medal. He was not a loser. He was a patriot, and the people left behind were heroes.
Really?
And I resent
Are you talking about
Mike
Hunter?
Hell.
Are you talking about
I'm
Hunter?
Talking
about
my son, Bo Biden. You're talking
about
heroes.
I don't know Bo. I know Hunter. Hunter got thrown out of the military. He was thrown out, dishonorably discharged.
That's not true.
For
it wasn't dishonorably.
Cocaine use.
Both USA Today and the Wall Street Journal reported in mid-October of 2014 that Hunter Biden was discharged from the military after testing positive for cocaine. It was, however, called an administrative discharge, less than honorable, but not quite the same as dishonorable. And the Wall Street Journal said at the time it isn't clear which discharge Mr. Biden received, and the Navy isn't commenting. Let me think, though. Wasn't his daddy still vice president at the time?
He was thrown out, dishonorably discharged.
That's not true. He wasn't dishonorably.
Cocaine use. And he didn't have a job until you became vice president. And once you became vice president, he made a fortune in Ukraine, in China, in Moscow,
that is simply
and various
not
other places.
True.
He
my
made
son,
a fortune.
Gentlemen, my son.
And he didn't have a job.
My son, like a lot of people we know at home, had a drug problem. He's overtaken it. He's fixed it. He's worked on it. And I'm proud of him.
But why was he given tens of millions of dollars?
All right. But he wasn't given tens of millions of dollars. That is totally,
discredited.
Discredited.
The president did later try to return to that topic, whether the Biden-Wallace ticket liked it or not.
Just out of curiosity, the mayor of Moscow's wife gave your son $3.5 million. What did he do to deserve it? What did he do with Burisma to deserve $183,000?
None of that is true.
You've asked a question, let him answer.
None of that is true.
Oh, really? He
totally
didn't get
Mr. President,
it's
Mr.
Totally,
President, please.
Totally discredited. Totally discredited. And by the way.
Well, wait, he didn't get $3.5 million, Joe?
Mr. Vice,
he got $3.5 million.
That is not true.
Oh, really,
Mr. President? It's an open discussion. Please,
it's a fact.
Well, you have raised an issue. Let the Vice
totally
President answer.
Discredited.
Did Burisma pay him $183,000 a month with no experience in energy?
Mr. President,
look, my son did nothing wrong at Burisma.
I think he did.
Mr. President, let him answer.
He doesn't want to let me answer because he knows I have the truth. His position has been totally, thoroughly discredited.
By who?
In Ukraine.
The media.
By everybody. Well, by the media, by our allies, by the World Bank, by everyone has discredited.
And furthermore, folks, we're expunging the net right now of any references to any alternatives, so you're not even going to be able to talk about it.
Matter of fact, even the people who testified under oath.
So let
under
me ask
oath.
You this, Joe.
Go ahead, mister. I'm listening to you.
People
you got $3.5 million from Moscow.
He testified under oath in his administration, said, I did my job and I did it very well.
Oh, really?
I did it
I'd
honorably.
Like to know who they are.
I'll give you the list
I'll
of the people
them.
Who testified.
No, go ahead, sir.
Sure, you've already fired most of them because they did
some
a good job.
Some people don't
well,
do a good
here's
job.
The,
with you,
go ahead. Wait a minute. You get the final word, Mr.
Well, it's hard to get any word in with this clown. Excuse me.
Hey, let me just say to you.
No. I'm Mr. President.
$3.5 million, Joe.
That is simply
why did
not
he deserve $3.5 million from Moscow?
Look, here's the deal. We want to talk about families and ethics. I don't want to do that.
Obviously, and we know why, and Chris Wallace did everything he could to help him. Still, though, it was pretty darn disgusting to listen to, so I'll skip ahead to the end of this little charade.
That's what we're talking about.
All right, that's the end of the segment. We're moving on.
It didn't take them.
Well, Vice President,
can I be honest? It's a very important question.
Try to
question.
Be honest.
No,
I
stood up.
No,
the
answer to the question is no.
Ukraine.
Sir.
With $1 billion, if you don't get rid of
that,
you
know what?
You're
not true.
You're doing it.
You're
going to
have
true,
gentlemen. I hate to raise my voice, but it seems to me, why shouldn't I be different than the two of you?
Yeah, I lie. I make a lot of money, and I've never been elected to anything, right, Chris? Perhaps, folks, the thing I found personally most disappointing was President Trump's failure to capitalize on the softballs he was thrown and to answer honestly and call out some of the BS of political correctness. Yeah, they were traps. And if Trump was the kind of leader people thought they elected, he'd have answered them head on. Case in point, climate science, as Chris Wallace kept trying to hammer home, as if somehow or other the man-made global warming BS that we're being fed has anything to do with science. Listen to this.
Okay. The forest fires in the West are raging now. They have burned millions of acres. They have displaced hundreds of thousands of people. When state officials there blame the fires on climate change, Mr. President, you said, I don't think the science knows. Over your 4 years, you have pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Accord. You have rolled back a number of Obama environmental records. What do you believe about the science of climate change?
Correct answer, it's bought and paid for. It's not real science.
What do you believe about the science of climate change, and what will you do in the next 4 years to confront it?
I want crystal clean water and air. I want beautiful, clean air. We have now the lowest carbon. If you look at our numbers right now, we are doing phenomenally. But I haven't destroyed our businesses. Our businesses aren't put out of commission. If you look at the Paris Accord, it was a disaster from our standpoint. And people are actually very happy about what's going on because our businesses are doing well. As far as the fires are concerned, you need forest management in addition to everything else. The forest floors are loaded up with trees, dead trees that are years old, and they're like tinder, and leaves and everything else. You drop a cigarette in there, the whole forest burns down.
And yeah, if you throw a Molotov cocktail or two in there, it's even worse.
You drop a cigarette in there, the whole forest burns down. You've got to have forest management.
What do you
believe?
What do you believe about the science of climate change, sir?
Wallace said it again. He should have been called out. The so-called science, sir, is bullshit, and I can prove it. There's been no global warming in the better part of two decades, and man's carbon footprint has a heck of a lot less to do with it than the sun.
I believe that we have to do everything we can to have immaculate air, immaculate water, and do whatever else we can that's good. You know, we're planting a billion trees, the Billion Tree Project, and it's very exciting.
You believe
for a lot of people.
That human pollution, gas, greenhouse gas emissions contributes to the global warming of this planet?
I think a lot of things do, but I think to an extent, yes. I think to an extent, yes. But I also think we have to do better management of our forests. Every year I get the call, California's burning. California's burning. If that was cleaned, if you had forest management, good forest management, you wouldn't be getting those calls.
Fine. Not an absolutely horrible answer, just a really wimpy one. And by the way, he did the very same thing when he was asked about masks and his large campaign gatherings. I really would have liked to have heard the president come right out and tell the truth. The American people are sick and tired of being fed BS through a mask. They know better. They know what's good for them and what's not. Some even have a clue about what's constitutional and what's an attempt to simply turn them into slaves. And they're ready to stand up and say, I'd like to try to have my life back again. I didn't hear that either. And those were arguably some of the biggest disappointments of a night of missed opportunities. About the only thing that came out of this segment that was halfway positive was Joe Biden first denying he had anything or any desire on behalf of the Green New Deal, and then turning it right around, I guess he forgot, and saying only a minute or two later, oh yeah, he's a big fan of it. Maybe somebody told him through his earwig what his website said. Chris Wallace, by the way, played the same disgusting game with the not even thinly veiled anti-white racism called critical race theory. When he tried to ask a leading question, saying, this month your administration directed federal agencies to end racial sensitivity training. No, that's exactly the opposite of what it really was. Why did you do that, he said, to end racial sensitivity training? And do you believe that there is systemic racism in this country, sir? When did you quit beating your wife, too? And at least this once, the president was honest and blunt.
This month, your administration directed federal agencies to end racial sensitivity training that addresses white privilege or critical race theory. Why did you decide to do that, to end racial sensitivity training? And do you believe that there is systemic racism in this country, sir?
I ended it because it's racist. I ended it because a lot of people were complaining that they were asked to do things that were absolutely insane, that it was a radical revolution that was taking place in our military, in our schools, all over the place, and you know it, and so does everybody else.
What is radical about racial sensitivity training?
If you were a certain person, you had no status in life. It was sort of a reversal. And if you look at the people, we were paying people hundreds of thousands of dollars to teach very bad ideas and, frankly, very sick ideas. And really, they were teaching people to hate our country. And I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to allow that to happen. We have to go back to the core values of this country. They were teaching people that our country is a horrible place, it's a racist place, and they were teaching people to hate our country. And I'm not going to allow that to happen.
Before we put this behind us, I do have to mention the incitement to violence issue and, of course, the attempt to undermine the election, both of which were spun and slanted something fierce. But truth be told, exactly as we would have expected. Obviously paying homage to the peaceful protester official narrative, sycophant Chris Wallace turned to the president and basically said, hey, all of your right-wing extremist voters are clearly planning to riot if you don't win, so will you call them out?
You have repeatedly criticized the vice president for not specifically calling out Antifa and other left-wing extremist groups. But are you willing tonight to condemn white supremacists and militia groups and to say that they need to stand down and not add to the violence in a number of these cities, as we saw in Kenosha?
Wrong. What a liar. Kenosha was clearly self-defense, and everybody who's honestly looked at it knows that by now.
Need to stand down and not add to the violence in a number of these cities, as we saw in Kenosha and as we've seen in Portland.
Sure,
are you
I'm
prepared
to
specifically
that,
do it?
Well,
I would say almost everything I see is from the left wing, not from the right wing.
So what are you saying?
I'm willing to do anything. I want to see peace.
Then do it, sir.
Say it.
And listen to this Wallace-Biden tag team.
Peace. Then do it, sir.
Say it.
Do you want to call him? What do you want to call them? Give me a name.
White supremacists and
right wing. Who would you like me to condemn?
White supremacists and right wing.
Proud Boys, stand back and stand by. But I'll tell you what. Somebody's got to do something about Antifa and the left, because this is not a right wing problem.
This is a left wing problem. Antifa's an idea, not an organization.
Oh, you got it.
Not militia. That's what FBI director
gentlemen,
said.
Well, then you know what?
We're done, sir. We're moving on to the next.
Everybody in your administration tells you the truth has a bad idea.
Can I tell you what?
You have no ideas.
Antifa is a dangerous radical.
All right,
radical
gentlemen,
group.
We're now moving on to the Trump and Biden records.
They'll overthrow you.
When a president, I'm going to ask a question.
So you guys had better shut up. Trump refuses to condemn white supremacists and militia members, says the WAPO banner headline. Trump won't condemn white supremacy, says the New York Times. No mention of the fact that Antifa is not particularly a concern, especially for Joe Biden.
Antifa's an idea, not an organization.
Oh, you got it.
Not militia.
All right, well, on to the election rigging. And the New York Times headline says everything you need to know about the left spin. Trump hectoring, says their main headline this morning, upends debate as he attacks integrity of election. And under that it says, President Trump dramatically escalated his effort to cast doubt upon the election results. I couldn't help but hearken back to the Hillary Clinton debate when they kept wanting to ask him, when you lose, will you concede? Trying later to excuse his shameless partisanship, Wallace told another interviewer on Fox that he'd bake this beautiful, delicious cake and, quote, frankly, the president put his foot in it, unquote. When it's all said and done, folks, I think probably Chris Wallace missed the lick. He should have started off his unbiased moderation of the debate with this question. Mr. President, we have confirmed reports, and I have to ask this, when did you quit beating Melania? But I do have to wrap up this segment on a more serious note. Given how the presidential COVID story stinks to high heaven for whole bunches of reasons, including obvious precautions being taken, you do have to ask the obvious follow-up question, is it a cover story for something else? And as for candidates on that front, from the deep state to communist China and Russia, yeah, I do repeat myself, to, and equally obviously, assassination, the possibilities are many. We'll be right back. When I think back,
back on all the crap I learned in high school. It's a wonder I can think at all. And my lack of education hasn't hurt me none. I can read the writing.
Welcome back now to the second segment for this evening. This is your host, Mark Hall. And there is one other thing we need to spend some time on this week, arguably because you're not going to hear any honest treatment of it in the debates, if there even are any at this point. The biggest debt bubble in human history, based entirely on dishonest weights and measures, a.k.a. fiat money, will not end well. The closest either candidate got to admitting what's really going on was when the president, once again, looked at the stock market as if that was the only indicator that really matters to middle America, not to mention to the rest of the world, with the implication that unless and until it collapses like the rest of the economy, well, we're not going to pay any attention to it, and we're just going to keep on printing like there's no tomorrow, because so far as Big Brother's concerned, there isn't. For his part, the senile one blames Trump for shutting down the economy, although most of the left called Trump an anti-China bigot, come to think of it, when he first tried it. And now, on one hand, Creepy Joe blames Trump for the economy still being shut down, but on the other hand, he'll make sure it stays shut down. And if you think that's more than a bit self-contradictory, well, welcome to the mind, but hopefully not the planned dystopia of Joe Biden. Trouble is, the biggest debt bubble in human history was there before Trump, and it's only gotten a whole lot bigger. The supply chain breakdowns are, plural, already a done deal, and the coming currency meltdown is also, likewise, baked in the cake. So let's take a look at that which they very much don't want you to. First, from one of the best Austrian-oriented sites out there, Sprott's Money Blog, inflation is already here, says their headline, also courtesy of Zero Hedge. The Fed may, yeah, may's probably an understatement, have a major problem on its hands. And in late August, they begin, the Fed unveiled their new flexible average inflation target, or FATE, paradigm. How's that for a misnomer that really does ring true? Which still, while lacking strict forward guidance and operational parameters, like what is the target inflation, what is the period over which they're going to look, and how long will they allow any overshoot to last, well, means that according to the latest Fed Open Market Committee projections, the Fed expects rates to be held at zero, or maybe even lower, through at least 2023. There's just one problem. Well, technically two, they say. For the Fed's AIT scheme to work, inflation will have to be low enough to where even if it rises above that 2% longer-term target, overshoot will be manageable and it won't take place for a while. But now it appears already that even official readings of both good inflation and wage inflation are starting to creep up substantially and could jeopardize the Fed's inflation overshoot target as soon as next year. At this point, they begin with a look back at history. I'm going to take a look back even a bit further with a related piece from Alistair MacLeod via goldmoney.com, also repeated on Zero Hedge, about other lessons from even further back in the past, notably the German hyperinflation of the early 1920s, which they say is relevant to the whatever-it-takes inflationary policies of today's governments and their central banksters, as is, if you remember, the Mississippi bubble of John Law literally centuries ago when he used paper money to rig the market, and that's precisely what central banksters are doing today. Anyway, looking at the progress, he says, of the collapse of the paper mark from its parity with the gold mark, starting back before 1920, we can literally compare where the dollar is today to that scale. The dollar, as listeners here probably know, has lost over 98% of its purchasing power since the failure of the London gold pool as recently as the late 1960s. And that puts the dollar at 56 on the mark chart, which is approximately where Germany's paper mark valuation was relative to gold during the first half of 1922. If, and this is a big if, admittedly, but it's certainly illustrative, it follows the same course as the paper mark, in just 5 or 6 months' time, it will be $100, and then in 10 or 12 months, at about $12,000. Compare that to gold instead of the paper mark and its original pre-1914 parity to the gold mark, The dollar, remember, following FDR's criminality, once started at $35 to the ounce. So that gold price in dollars today would be $1,960. Yep, that makes sense. We're still about there. Then $3,500 within just 5 or 6 months. Whoa, that certainly will surprise some folks. But wait a second. Within 10 to 12 months, it puts it at $42,000 to the ounce. Well, the final price at which the German inflation was stopped back on 20 November 1923, when it was again fixed to the Rentenmark at the rate of a trillion to one, would be the equivalent today of $35 trillion to the ounce. Well, playing around with figures like these, says McLeod, is not a replacement for sound reasoning, but it does impart an interesting perspective. Because a better understanding of the possible demise, inevitable demise, I would say, of the unbacked dollar is not to think of it in terms of dollars per ounce anymore. After all, when dollars go to zero, that number goes to infinity. The question instead is, can you think of gold as being broadly stable while the dollar simply loses its purchasing power? Well, with that in mind, they take a look back at 1920s hyperinflation in Germany and make a disturbing observation. There's hardly an economist today who does not condemn the Reichsbank for its inflationary policies, yet they're supportive of very similar monetary policies by the Fed, the European Central Bank, the Bank of Japan, and the Bank of England. What we need to do is compare the stewardship of Rudolf Havenstein at the Reichsbank with that of Jay Powell at the Fed, who, after reducing interest rates the previous week, 23rd of March this year, issued an FOMC statement promising an inflationary policy of whatever it takes. And Rishi Sunak, the British Chancellor of the Exchequer, used that phrase multiple times during his emergency budget discussions. But there is a difference. Today, alternatives to inflationism are simply never discussed amongst policymakers, who are like a blind cult, believing entirely, and thus only with minor variations, that monetary inflation is the cure for whatever ails you, at least economically. At least in Germany, though, the actions of the government were the subject of wider debate, both in Germany and outside of it, even though the answers were pretty much, then as now, ill-informed. He goes on to some more details of the German collapse. We've talked about those before, and it's a pretty lengthy story. What I want to do is get to some of the other parallels with where we really are today. So let's take a look at this point. Having resorted, he says, to monetary inflation as a means of marginal finance, it rapidly became the principal source of government revenue in hyperinflationary Weimar Germany. Today we print money and are able, at least for now, to pretend that there are no consequences. Isn't that interesting? But the disparity between increases in the money supply in Germany and the effect on the then paper mark purchasing power was so great that the accuracy of the underlying numbers, you know, what they were trying to measure, really doesn't matter. Today, is it true that we can presumably rely on monetary statistics as being reasonably accurate? Well, they, in other words, think they know how much money they've printed. But the statistics that reflect the effect on prices certainly are not, and we'll come back to that in a minute. Today's suppression, though, of increases in the general price level, says Alistair McLeod, simply disqualifies any statistical analysis. And in that sense, the observations of a prominent German economist of the time, their version of an MMT expert, almost the same modern monetary theory, Karl Helfferich, is at least a more honest appraisal than those of today's monetary planners. And there's this parallel, too. The starting point of all of the logic, and he quotes that guy at length, is that it's never the government's fault, but it's always the fault of external factors and market. Yeah, it was foreign currencies and German war reparations and those kind of things that were the problem with the Weimar Republic. Today, yeah, say it with me, folks, it's COVID-1984. Massive debt and printing funny money has nothing to do with it. And doubtless, continues the author here, as the dollar declines in the foreign exchanges over coming months and commodity prices inevitably rise, we'll continue to see similar arguments embedded in future FOMC statements. Given upcoming events, says Alistair McLeod, we can see a similar trend for today's paper money, even if they're really mostly digital bits, particularly when represented by the American dollar. Remember when the first wave of COVID-1984 was assumed to be a one-off? Oh, 2 weeks, flattened the curve, and we're done, hitting the American economy, but that was going to be followed by a rapid return to normal, the V-shaped recovery. Well, we certainly didn't get any return to normal, and so far, at least, no hint of a V. Everywhere, though, the official story was the same. Following lockdowns to the economy, if they were ever removed, and they haven't been, then things will get back to normal. Well, now we have a new normal, and you know things are never going to get back to anything approaching that old normal. But it did manage to drive the U.S. budget deficit to over $3.3 trillion in the fiscal year just ending, up from a previously forecast less than one-third of that, a mere trillion fake bucks or so. And the federal deficit is now already 100% of federal tax revenues. As I've mentioned, the author goes into a lot more parallels, not only with Weimar Germany, but also John Law's infamous Mississippi bubble all the way back in 1720, and points out that the major consistency here is that the final collapse of a currency is always a flight out of government fiat and into real stuff, goods. And it would be a mistake to think that can't happen again. Because, you know, history may not repeat exactly, but as Mark Twain pointed out, it certainly does rhyme. Well, then back to Sprott's money blog and his bit of history, where more recently he says what we're seeing is just a purposeful lack of clarity from Jay Powell and other previous Fed heads. Probably the closest thing we got to it was when helicopter Ben Bernanke said, yeah, we're going to fire up those helicopters. And it now looks like Powell is fixing to do it. The problem emerges, says Sprott, depending upon where one looks. You can make the argument that much of what U.S. consumers are spending money on today and seeing, therefore, price increases on is already, if not at or above, those Fed inflation overshoot targets that they're now talking about. Nobody, he says, though, made the point better than the Wall Street Journal, which over this weekend wrote that, quote, inflation is already here. Well, at least for the stuff that you actually want to buy. As James McIntosh writes for the WSJ, if it feels like the prices of everything you buy have been soaring, that's because it has. Even as central banksters, he didn't spell it right, everywhere worry about the dangers of deflation. He then points out that the massive gap between what everyday people experience and the annual alleged inflation rate of only 1.3%, and notes that, quote, the price of the stuff we're buying is rising much faster, while the price of the stuff we're no longer buying has been falling, but still counts in the figures. And isn't that convenient? Which makes sense, after all, says Sprott, because with more demand for a given good or service, prices will jump and vice versa. And what the post-COVID data, wait a minute, there is no post-COVID data, folks. COVID has been and will be a permanent thing, don't you know? Anyway, the work-from-home age, as he puts it, has given annual inflation for certain products that's now solidly overshooting the Fed's targets. Start, for example, with the cost of food at home, where so many Americans have been spending so much of their time. That was up almost 5%, 4.6, according to their numbers, in August, compared with a year earlier. That's the biggest rise in almost a decade. That's not true, though, in school and workplace cafeterias, which were 3% cheaper, because there's nobody there and most of them to buy it. And while food prices are traditionally volatile, they note, the same pattern emerges from many things sensitive to those of us sitting at home talking on Zoom. Few home workers need a new suit or a dress. They're down 17%. Makeup is down 3%. Or a hotel room down 13%, those that are still in business. Or air tickets down 23%. At the same time, the following activities have all seen sharp price increases. Sitting at home in your PJs, men's nightwear, is up 4%. Cycling, bikes are up 6%. Reading for pleasure, books up 4%. Newspapers even up 5%. And so on. Yep, even sewing machines are up 9%. And think about that one. It could mean folks are planning ahead, too. The swings in buying habits, continues the author, have also accentuated a core aspect of the current inflation versus deflation debate, namely how inflation is officially being measured, with an emphasis on the difference between the so-called Consumer Price Index, or CPI, and the Personal Consumption Expenditure Price Index, or PCE. And as the journal reminds us, CPI captures the headlines and determines the return on inflation-linked treasuries, or TIPS, while the Federal Reserve uses PCE, and the two have diverged pretty widely since the summer. Gee, folks, who could have thought it? And another reason, continues Sprott, why prices have spiked in recent months, is that the pandemic provided inflationary pressure by restricting supply. That's what happens when supply chains break and people simply can't buy stuff whether they want it or not. Yeah, think toilet paper for a while, and then food in the not-too-distant future, so that when demand rises, for example, eating out as lockdowns eased, prices rose sharply. Now, I'm going to pause on that note because there's another factor here at work, too. If you have a restaurant and you're worried that you're going to have to shut your doors and you've already been laying people off and most of them you can't hire back anyway because they're making more sitting home and eating bonbons, and in a lot of places you're only allowed to open 25% of your capacity anyway, what does it make sense to do? Oh, yeah, for those few that can afford to eat out, charge them more because you can't even cover your costs anyway, and besides, you can't fill your seats. So doesn't it seem obvious that inflation would be a big part of that picture? This is one of those simple things that people running for president don't seem to be able to grasp, and those asking the questions at silly debates aren't about to ask anyway, says Luigi Speranza, chief global economist at BNP Paribas. In the short term, the demand shock prevails, so we'll have subdued prices for the next year to 18 months, especially where lingering effects of the pandemic mean less need for things like travel and tourism workers for years. And there are other knockoff effects, too. Some are worried about deflationary side effects of upcoming macro transformations, especially, for example, how a wave of delinquencies and defaults across commercial property might lead to widespread, and at least in this case, deflationary debt destruction as many workers leave to find something else to do. The bottom line is that while many debate what happens next, the current reality is still stark. Surging prices for things that Americans actually need, offset by declining prices for things they don't or no longer need. This, according to the Fed, washes out and doesn't merit tighter financial conditions, even though for the average American on Main Street, the ongoing price spike has proven to be especially painful. And it's, I guess, doubly painful, folks, if the things you were using to make a living are those things that people can't afford, can't get, and no longer decide they need anyway. For years, by the way, your host has been saying that what I expect to see as the currency melts down is precisely this: hyperinflation in some areas, massive deflation in others. And if you're one of those that likes to lie with figures, you can average those out and say, hey, look, see, everything's, on average, just fine. But there's more on the inflation front as well. To be sure, continues Sprott, much of this is due to the government's transfer payments having exploded and their creeping experiment in so-called universal basic income. In other words, folks, unbridled communism. Send everybody a check and damn the torpedoes, don't worry about the effects. But one thing is safe to say, regardless of who allegedly wins the election, the massive money printing and handouts will continue into the next administration, especially if people claim they don't want to see even more daily riots. But the bottom line is that between the massive government so-called stimulus and the organic demand for those that are still highly skilled and still employed workers, the Fed may soon be shocked at how quickly wage inflation returns, in addition to the runaway inflation for things Americans need that we've already talked about. In short, he says, absent a double-dip recession or a sharp economic contraction, and don't count on that absence, inflation, especially in its most benign and welcome form, wages, may already be at more than double the Fed's AIT target. And if that's sustained, it leaves the Fed with three options. Number one, they can hike rates far sooner than the claimed 2023. Number two, the definition of hourly wages and prices can be changed, revised. Yeah, let's just change how we lie about the figures. What do you bet the odds are of that? In a way to make them appear smaller. And that, by the way, is just what Japan has been doing. And it's also what's been happening here since at least the Clinton regime. Or number three, the Fed will merely move the goalposts and change the AIT framework, saying, oh, well, you know, we said 2%. No, well, we went 3% or 4% or 40%. Any way you slice it, though, he suggests, the Fed not only has some splaining to do, but more trouble ahead. Which brings me to the piece I've been working up to from the Reagan-era budget advisor and number cruncher par extraordinaire, David Stockman, who was interviewed on theinternationalman.com not long ago, primarily about the economy's role, if any, in the upcoming presidential election. They hearken back to Clinton's phrase, it's the economy, stupid, and it turns out that's who they were talking to. Says Stockman, a Republican, but not a never-Trumper, and still no fan of President Trump, In the befuddled mind of Donald Trump, the economy will probably play a considerable role, as manifest in his campaign oratory. And with less than 50 days left until the election, he might get away with some of his groundless boasting. In other words, he continues, we seriously doubt that the great coming reckoning will commence before November 3rd, meaning he'll be able to keep peddling the except for COVID, things would have been wonderful, canard, claiming that before that, he had single-handedly created the greatest economy ever. Actually, continues Stockman, it's the greatest BS story ever told, because it rests on the utterly misleading circumstance that the Donald entered office at the 90th month of what became the longest business cycle expansion, even if it was one of the wimpiest and most anemic in modern history. It passed 128 months, Stockman notes, back in February. So consequently, his record, such as it is, was artificially flattened by low U3 unemployment rates at 3.5% that naturally occurred during those last 38 months of the business cycle, as the inventory of unused labor is finally exhausted. Of course, he says that's also exactly what occurred during the final months of the 1990s 118-month expansion and the 106-month expansion back in the 1960s, when it just happened to be Democrats that were incumbent in the Oval Office. But if you measure something relevant, like average real GDP growth during his tenure, it turns out that the Donald doesn't look all that hot. Even though, as Stockman admits, in spite of his best efforts, that's not all the fault of the Donald. The fact is, he says, the U.S. economy was sinking under the dead weight of $77 trillion of public and private debt, and the decades of public waste and private malinvestment that this debt explosion enabled. Now, Donald's wrong-headed sponsorship of the lockdown nation via the recommendations of his malpracticing so-called doctors and the public hysteria they fostered has delivered the final coup de grace. So yeah, it's still the economy, stupid, which is to say, whoever wins on November 3rd, and more likely, folks, nobody wins on November 3rd until the Congress manages to cause constitutional chaos a couple of months after that, is going to inherit an economy that's so battered, bruised, and freighted with speculative excesses and debilitating debt that whoever ends up as the alleged winner will go down in history as the president that made Herbert Hoover look like a big winner. The next question has to do with the United States being more divided than it's been in the memory of any living person. And what do you make of all that? Stockman was asked. What are the consequences for the U.S. fiat dollar and for things like gold and silver? Well, says Stockman, there's only one thing to do. That's get out of the casino and sell any security that moves or stands still. Because the bipartisan duopoly has lost all contact with the principles of sound money, fiscal rectitude, and minimalist government intervention, on which the old concept of sustainable capitalist prosperity depends. For example, he says, the GOP Senate is so oblivious to the monstrous fraud being perpetrated by the nation's central banksters that it can't even muster the votes to put one single once and former sound money advocate, he's talking about Judy Shelton, on the Fed's Board of Governors. Indeed, the Judy Shelton nomination failure is the monetary Rubicon, meaning there's literally no hope left that our stupefied politicians can move to stop the Monetary Politburo, domiciled in the Eccles Building, he's talking about the Federal Reserve, of course, from utterly destroying the capital and money markets that are at the heart of the capitalist system. What lies ahead, therefore, is more years of massive monetization of the public debt and never-before-imagined fiscal profligacy on both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue. Already, the public debt at $27.7 trillion stands at 138%, once unthinkable numbers as a percentage of GDP, even though there's still zero will in either party to break its ascent. And at some point, he says, in the hopefully not too near future, confidence in the monetary printing scam at the Fed will finally evaporate, at which point look out below, because the financial sins of at least half a century will come crashing all around. Stockman was asked by the International Man, when the COVID lockdowns first started, government said we needed just a few weeks to flatten the curve, with the idea that things would get restarted relatively easily. 6 months later, though, COVID-1984 hysteria still rules, most economic activity is still at a standstill, and the far left wants to mask everybody down, bend them over, socialists track them, and make things even worse, with hardly any resistance from the alleged right. So they ask, is it even possible for Main Street to bounce back, and what kind of long-term damage do you think already has been done? says Stockman. It's certainly immense and arguably well-nigh irreversible. That's because, quote, never before, even during the full military mobilization of World War II, have we had this kind of draconian economic martial law. And as it was, the U.S. economy was already a hand-to-mouth cripple. But when the lockdowns came smashing down out of the blue in March, businesses had no dry powder. They'd already weighted down their balance sheets with cheap debt to fund stock buybacks, as well as their massively overvalued M&A deals, and likewise, 80% of U.S. households had borrowed to the hilt, and they didn't have any funds for a rainy day left to speak of. Bottom line, says Stockman, no sane person, and that should include the Fed but doesn't, would want more inflation in this environment. But we're going to get it. So get out of paper and get what's real while you still can.